Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our explorations of the cultures of consciousness. A few weeks ago, we had a fascinating guest on Expanding Mind, David Normal, who was talking about his visionary artwork, and we also spent a little bit of time chatting about some of the remarkable footage of trance ceremonies that he shot in Southeast Asia, and Bali, Thailand, Burma. And I just went onto his site, Loose Spirits, loosespirits.net, and he just has a few items up there, but I watched an eight-minute clip called The Battle of the Palanquins from Bali. And it basically, it's a village ceremony, folks, in somewhat casual traditional garb. It's not a big tourist performance. And there's these groups of young men who are carrying, I believe, eight different palanquins, and who are sort of roving around the village and then making their way towards a narrow gate in the temple walls, and then they enter back into the temple where they're then given offerings. And, so it's a kind of entertaining situation. There's all these young men, they're still shouting, there's kind of mock sort of, not quite battles, but sort of confrontations between the different groups carrying the palanquins. But there's something odd that happens as they get closer to the temple. At some point, it no longer seems that these gentlemen are carrying, a palanquin with a little hut on it, and inside the hut is a locked box that has within it the what you could call an idol, or the god, the figure. But at some point, it no longer seems like they're carrying this object so much as being driven by this object. And by the time they come to putting the palanquin through this narrow gate, it's very clear that none of them are in control, and that the palanquin is sort of resisting and shaking, and it's sort of like that moment in a Ouija board where suddenly no one seems to be controlling the movement of the planchette across the board. And I'm very interested in that moment. It's a very subtle but very noticeable shift. And it happens to you as an observer, as a participant, even if you don't have any over-beliefs in what's happening. Like, oh, this is the point where the god starts to get grumpy, or this is how it's always been done, et cetera, et cetera. It's something that you can sense on a more basic level, almost the same level that you have when you go into a room and you feel like somebody else is there. Now, some cognitive scientists will say, oh, well, that's just a feature of the brain. It projects this sense of agency because it's learned through, millions of years that if you project the idea of agency, you're more likely to recognize the tiger before the tiger gets you, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe that's the case. Nonetheless, it's a remarkable kind of experience, and it's something that we can also think about, and that I've been thinking a lot about, and I know our guest today, Dr. Robert Wallace, has thought a lot about as well, this moment that we can call an animistic moment, where suddenly an object in the world, an idol, a tree, even a sentient creature that we know has some kind of consciousness, suddenly becomes more seemingly self-aware, more agential, something that's doing something in the world, and it changes our relationship, it changes our sense of self, it changes our sense of possibly even what consciousness is and where it's located. So in addition to being a remarkable zone of personal experiential exploration, this sort of animist engagement with the world is also a very interesting thing to think about, and says a lot about where we are in terms of religion, in terms of ecology, in terms of our changing sense of self. So I'm very happy that we'll have Dr. Wallace on the show today. He is a professor of visual culture at Richmond University, which is near or in London. And I've had the pleasure of sharing the stage with him on a couple of times in my journeys to the UK, and I'm always fascinated to hear his discussions of shamanism, neo-shamanism, pagan sites, art, animism. And so with all these juicy topics on the table, let's begin. Robert, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Well, thanks for inviting me, Eric. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
That's great. You know, I was thinking of like how to kick the whole thing off, and if you don't mind, I'm kind of curious on a sort of more personal level. Is when, given the range of things that you think about and that you've participated in a sort of experiential way and thought about and written about, when you think about your own life, is there a sort of moment, maybe when you were a child, when you were in the woods or reading or some kind of sort of moment in your own past where you can kind of identify the encounter with something that in some ways set in motion all of these various interests that you've built into a career, into an academic career and a personal sort of line of development? Is there kind of like a sort of starting point or at least an influential moment in your own life that really opened up this door?
Well, I can think of a couple of different times which are of significance, and I think that while they might be specific to me, they're probably common to a number of other people who are interested in these kinds of subjects that we're interested in personal and scholarly ways. I remember sitting in the middle of my bedroom as a child, I don't know if I was maybe 5 or 6, 7 years old, and contemplating death and finding a particular space where the idea of death was a challenge to me, but for some reason it didn't really matter. And I think that was a point at which I identify there was something significant going on for me. And beyond that, beyond the bedroom, as it were, my mother always encouraged me to engage with nature, to be interested in the natural world. And I think it was in those moments, those explorations of just the garden or local parks or woods, where I felt that I was re-engaging with that kind of numinous experience. And I didn't really make sense of it in a religious way or a spiritual way at all until much later, when I was 16 years old, and I can identify that year because I remember specifically. And I encountered paganism for the first time, or at least a show on paganism on the television. And it struck me that everything that this Wiccan priest was talking about resonated very strongly with the sorts of encounters I'd had, the feelings I'd had, the thinking I was going through. So that was quite powerful for me, and I self-identified from that point as a pagan. And a lot's changed since then, and I wouldn't necessarily identify myself in quite that simple way anymore. But it was that from that moment, in common with other pagans, I think, where I felt that I had a coming home experience, that everything I'd been going through made sense in some way.
Yeah, it's remarkable that sense of resonance. You use the term, and I've been thinking about that term a lot because it's something that I don't think we quite acknowledge it has as much power as it does, and I'm thinking here both intellectually and personally, where there's a kind of mystery around resonance, where it's someone is saying something, you're encountering something, you're reading something, and it just strikes in this really remarkably deep way, and you can trust that even if the sense of connection or the sense of identity maybe is not as intense as it seems initially, or as in your case, perhaps you dive into something like a pagan identity, a pagan practice, and then over time it changes, it develops, maybe you move in a different direction in relationship to it. But resonance is invariably worth following up. And it's funny because you can recognize it cognitively. You can say, oh, this fellow is saying things about nature that I believe. He's saying things about practice, even the appearance, the clothes. There are things that I'm attracted to. I like this moment. I like the sense of of the vibe of nature. But there's something very mysterious in it as well, very, very intuitive. And it's a real a skill that is related to the kinds of spaces, feelings, practices in paganism, in neo-shamanism, in the sort of new animism, that it's part of that that world is revealed through resonance, through following one's sort of intuitive recognition or sense of coming home or having already been part of something. So when you had that moment on the TV, and then you sort of dove into paganism. At what point did you start to think or go, actually, this is something I'm interested in intellectually. This is something that I can imagine studying, or studying things that are related to what I'm actually experiencing and exploring on a personal level. How did that sort of second thread develop in your own life?
Well, I suppose it came down to trying to make sense of and understand those resonant experiences that you described, and therefore reading a great deal, starting off with the likes of Crowley and Kenneth Grant and through Austin Spare, lots of difficult readings and lots of literature that was difficult to get hold of at that time. It's now freely available on the internet, but at that time it was very difficult to get hold of. And in some ways that just made it more difficult to understand, because obviously the language to express that depth of the resonant experience that you mentioned is not easy to do. But I wanted to try and make sense of those experiences I was having, and I wanted to find a way of expressing that, so I went through various traditions. And at the same time as doing that, I embarked on an undergraduate degree in archaeology at Southampton University, which I didn't get on too well with for the first couple of years. I found it all rather dry, and it didn't access the past in the way I wanted to be able to access it. It was very much about data and evidence, and that didn't chime so well for me at that point. And then I encountered a new lecturer at the university, Thomas Dowson, who was a rock art scholar, South African rock art scholar. And he'd been writing in his own work and with David Lewis Williams on shamanism and rock art, in particular in Southern Africa, and interpreting rock art through the evidence of shamanistic experience and through neuropsychological experiments and altered states of consciousness. And I suddenly thought, wow, this is interesting. This is really interesting material that I can engage with, and some of my experiences seem to relate to, because at that time I was reading quite a lot about shamanism and trying my own shamanic journeys through Hana-style journeying and other means. And that was where I really found the moment of both scholarly study and practical experience coming together in a way that was really important for me. And at that point I didn't really see how I could bring these two together professionally, if you like, and I had the fortunate experience of Thomas Dowson becoming my PhD supervisor, and at that point I thought I was going to do something on contemporary shamanism and rock art, but at that time we couldn't really find too much about that subject, and he said, well, why don't you do your PhD on neo-shamanism, given that that's what you're doing? And in particular I went on to focus on neo-shamanic practice and its implications for anthropologists and archaeologists. So in some ways I was studying myself and the people I practiced with spiritually, for want of a better word, but I was able to bring that into an academic setting, which had various challenges, but that was really the point where the two came together and I was able to, in some ways, come out as an insider within the religion that I was practicing and studying.
Yeah, there's so many wonderful things about that position. I mean, there's a lot of scholarship that around paganism and esotericism and new religious movements around these issues. They often features people who are insiders as well as outsiders, and it raises all sorts of interesting questions and problems. But the one that just popped into my head that I'd love to hear you talk about is that in a way, that being a participant observer with one foot in scholarship, where you're committed to a certain kind of explanatory regime, a certain way of describing, of having some objective distance, at the very least of using analytic language to talk about things, that then in your practice life, let's call it, are very much, they almost need to be not analyzed, at least temporarily, in order for them to really kind of get going. And that strikes me as being a really wonderful place to kind of look at, not the practices themselves, you know, what you're doing with your friends, the nature of the ritual, the chants, the clothes, the objects, but more the attitude that you bring to it. Because, you know, clearly, you know, more than most people, you have this capacity to take stock, take distance, analyze objectively, put in context, all these sort of intellectual moves that in many ways, you know, pull us outside of the lived pulse of life. And at the same time, you're developing this other facility, which is, despite all that, to go back into the space and maybe go back into it with even more intimacy and power and, motility. You're moving around. It's unfolding for you. So can you talk a little bit about that, like what you learned about entering into religious practice, pagan practice, what you learned about how to do that precisely because you were, you know, you needed to carve out a different place than just the sort of analytic mind of a scholar?
That's an interesting question. I think that tension between the distant scholar, the objective scholar, and the subjective immersed participant is a really interesting tension, and it's one that anthropologists have actually been thinking about for a very long time, but particularly since the 60s and 70s, and that inside or outside a problem in the study of religion, whether or not you lose your objectivity when studying a religion or being an insider within the religion, and whether that compromises your data. But of course, feminist and other scholars since the 60s have pointed out that there is no absolute objectivity, and we all bring our partial perspectives to whatever study we're performing. So the way it worked for me was that I, at the same time as doing my studies, I was practicing, as it were, but I was also trying to find a framework of a system within which to do my practice. I didn't want to just move from one thing to the next, from Crowley to Spare to Hana shamanism. And I ended up doing research into the heathen religions of the British Isles with a focus on the Anglo-Saxons, because there is quite rich material in that. While much of it was recorded by Christian monks, there's quite rich material there in terms of the Icelandic sagas, descriptions of sorcery and witchcraft, the runes. And I, with another practitioner, friend, scholar, Nathan Johnson, we wrote a book called Galdabok, Practical Heathen Runecraft, Shamanism and Magic, in which we tried to carve out an understanding of this material which would be useful for practice. And I found myself using that practice in my study of some of the material, the archaeological material I was working with, and certainly through using the runes, through scrying with a crystal sphere, I found things in the material that I don't think I would have found through pure objective study. And that sort of lended further credence to me for going in the route I was. It was trying to marry these two rather different things, except that, of course, they're only different and distinct because we define them as such, and probably tacking in between them is something that a lot of us do on a daily basis.
Very much so. That's a fascinating way of sort of taking that divide that I had suggested between your practice, like your insider life and your outsider life, and really sort of, you know, adding, as it were, a sort of loop through them, and so that the practices open up the scholarship as well. I mean, that's one of the impressions that I've gotten from you and from other pagan scholars or scholars who work with this kind of material, is the way in which these materials, they're read in, you know, ancient books. You're looking at you know, stones that have been lying around for sometimes thousands of years. Very old material, in some ways very distant, very difficult to engage with directly, and yet something seems to kind of come alive, or can come alive in the scholarship. I'm thinking of one talk you gave in particular that really, really changed my mind in a subtle but significant way, where you talked about mugwort and the role that this very interesting herb played in Anglo-Saxon lore, and there's some actual material that we can read and sort of get a sense of what that might have been, but also there's a lot of questions how it functioned, and that part of your way of engaging the meaning of mugwort and including its history, how it's been thought about, how it's been constructed, was were personal practices as well, an attempt to, you know, develop a relationship with the plant through smoking, through meditation, et cetera. And I've had occasion since then, it really popped in my head, like mugwort seemed suddenly very important to me, and it became something that I practice with and in the context of dream work in particular, but not simply that. And it really kind of struck me, because it was like, look, when you're asking what something is, what is the meaning of this piece of rock art? What is the meaning culturally of this plant? That the intuitive, relational kinds of approaches aren't necessarily so terribly different than the reading, analytic ones. That they can be very much more of a sort of a loop or a weave of these kinds of elements. But it also has to do with this question of relationship, of allowing a relationship to develop, whether it's a relationship to a particular place or, in this case, to a particular plant. So can you talk a little bit about that in terms of, and I know you've thought about this a lot, about what is that relational quality to places or things that mobilizes some of this deeper engagement?
Well, I was lucky enough during the writing of my PhD to read the work and meet and work with Graham Harvey. And he wrote a book entitled Animism, which came out in 2005, so it's a few years now. But I read that for the first time, and it really rocked me quite a lot. Up until that point, I think I'd been thinking in my scholarly work and my personal spiritual work about the way in which we relate to the world around us, be that to spirits, animal allies, or however we define the beings we work with, gods, spirits, and so on, as something that is out there to be contacted, or something that is within us, which is archetypal and emerging, a distinction between each of these things as sort of discrete categories. And one of the things that Graham Harvey talks about in this book on animism, both indigenous and contemporary animism, is that everything is formed in relationship. There are no pre-existing forms, and it's through relating that we come to understand these beings and other things that we work with and ourselves. We can never entirely know the other, and we can also never entirely know ourselves. So it's in that moment of relating that a lot of what happens in the world comes about. So recognizing the importance of relating with the world around us, forming relationships rather than imposing oneself upon it in a rather masculist, scientific way, was really quite important for me and really affected both my scholarly work and my practical work. And both of those came together in one sense with the work on mugwort, revisiting the nine herbs charm and other Anglo-Saxon literature which mentioned mugwort, and reading that in a new light based on this understanding of relationality and the forming of relationships. And doing that in a way which was less about trying to impose interpretation on the material and more trying to relate to the material so that it spoke to me. And I wouldn't want this to sound that like I'm in a unique or privileged position, or that I'm claiming that one can achieve that through certain practices. It's more a sense of the particular perspective that I bring to the work as a result, and the more people that are doing it, the better, the more perspective there will be on the material. And people may well understand mugwort and the literature that I've mentioned in very different ways, but that's again, is a part of the forming of relationship with the living world around us, which I find rather interesting.
Yeah, I've also been thinking on precisely that point. There's a sort of understandable resistance towards, let's call this a kind of animistic relationship, because it seems to imply, at least from one level, that you've actually figured out what the thing really is about. So, you know, you turn towards, let's just say, since we're talking about herbs, there's, you know, a million herbalists and books that are going to tell you what the characteristics of particular herbs are, what they're good for, how they speak to you, what they say, what their attitude is. I mean, it's even becoming commercialized now. There's a line of, like, herbal teas that you can get at the grocery store that have the describe the substance on the side. Let's say, like, I just had some nettle tea the other night, and one of the categories is personality. So they describe the personality of this substance. Mm. And so there's an inevitable kind of resistance to this. Oh, it seems kind of corny. It's like, how can you know? You know, there's not a singular creature on the other side there. But at the same time, that shouldn't prevent the unique encounter that is yours. And indeed, in my life, one of the things I've been working with is precisely these subtle things, these sort of ordinary herbs, things that aren't particularly psychoactive. Maybe they're slightly psychoactive, like green tea or calamus or mugwort, where they're subtle. So if you want to even recognize what the effect, so to say, which isn't even necessarily the right word, but what the effect of this engagement is, you have to be paying attention. And one of the best ways to pay attention is to adopt the attitude that this is actually a relationship or a conversation. It's not just the analytic mind going, I feel a little bit more tension in my chest, or, you know, I'm a little more relaxed. It's more like, what did you say? Wait, what are you whispering? It's a different set in the mind, in the heart. And yet, very different things come out of that process. And it seems to me that a lot of what happens in people's deepening experience with neo-shamanism, with much more intense allies, but also with subtle allies and ordinary daily practices, is precisely developing that capacity to enter into a kind of listening, a kind of relational sensitivity with things that our minds are going, well, you know, there's not really anything there. So it's like almost like a little theater that you create. But remarkable things happen there. And one of the things that happens in those sites that we haven't talked about, but I know is really important to you, are physical sites, are places. You know, it's like one of the great differences between paganism in America and in the UK is that in the UK there's this tremendous landscape that is just brimming with these remarkable sites, both archaeological and sort of, you know, topographical, imaginative, that have a rich and complex relationship with the people who are still living there. You don't have this horrific genocidal slaughter standing between you and the landscape where you live, like we do in the United States, which is, you know, a tremendously psychically difficult situation, which, you know, I'll leave aside. But speaking of the UK, I'm curious how you, both as a scholar and as a practitioner, partly learned to develop this kind of listening through going places, seeing things, seeing rock art sites, attempting to kind of move into landscape in that way.
Well, before I started my archaeology degree, I'd already developed an interest in archaeological monuments, particularly from Neolithic and Bronze Age England. And at that time, I was seeking out those places and visiting them as places which might be containing power of some kind, which had links to the people who walked these islands before as ancestors. And people I'd gone with to these sites might be dowsing for ley lines or energies of some kind, whatever they might be, and clearly the rods were moving and interesting things were happening, but what that meant, we didn't really know. Clearly there seemed to be some sort of energies at these sites, but trying to understand them was the problem. It was about trying to understand through physical effects, if you like, and I think the same thing stands for going back to the plant allies and mugwort among them, and talking about active constituents and how, as you said, how they're listed as the most relevant part because they're somehow going to affect us neurophysiologically. But one of the things that emerges from this new animism, as opposed to the old animism of Fraser and Tyler, is less to do with whether or not there is some sort of animating spiritual force in inanimate objects, and certainly not to do with whether indigenous people were making a mistake in recognizing that certain inanimate objects contain souls or energy of some kind. I think the interesting thing about the new animism is that it can move outside that problem to think about relating on the one hand, but also respectful forming of relationships. So I, for example, approaching mugwort or a sacred site, Stonehenge, Avebury, stone circles, and projecting some sort of essence or substance or energy into that site that can be tapped into, I think is its own form of colonialism, and that more interesting is to attempt to relate to these sites and negotiate relationships respectfully. And again, animism became particularly useful for me in that sense because my research at that point was moving on to specifically how pagans and related people and groups were engaging with these sites. And there would be some who would go to places like Avebury and say, we're going to awaken the spirits. And immediately there is there's a form of disrespectful approach to the site by not trying to ask it or listen in the first place, but to assume that there are spirits and that they need awakening. Something very sort of 20th century about this kind of approach. And there are more interesting things, I think, can emerge from attempting to negotiate respectful relationships with sites. And I think that's something that has come through the history of recent paganism in relating to sites, in that now we see other things happening which don't necessarily involve having to leave a physical offering which might in some way either damage the site through fire or which might encourage other people to go around leaving their rotting flowers and vegetables as offerings, but forming other forms of relationship or attempting to do that and listening in other ways which are more sensitive and respectful.
This is wonderful. I want to ask more about that and maybe get some concrete examples, but we got to take a break right now. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. We're talking with Robert Wallace about paganism, neo-shamanism, and sacred sites, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. We're talking with Robert Wallace about paganism and sacred sites. And before the break, you were painting what I think was is a very important, very interesting picture of different ways that, let's say, pagans have come to relate with sacred sites. Let's say a place like Avebury or a smaller stone circle off, in the woods somewhere, where we can understand and to some degree sympathize with the attitude of like, we're going to go here, we're going to leave an offering, we're going to reawaken the energies as part of our kind of resurrection of pagan energies. But as you point out, there's a subtle and maybe not so subtle kind of colonialism there, where it's like we're the ones who know what needs to happen to the space, as opposed to a kind of subtler listening, almost a questioning, a kind of respectful relationship that may not even manifest with physical offerings, obvious practices, fires, et cetera, for all sorts of reasons. So what's happening there? Well, what's an example of that? What's a sense where you got a snapshot of how that actually could look in practice, that kind of more reflexive and more respectful relationship to these admittedly very powerful places?
Well, what I do in my own practice as a heathen animist, for want of a better term, is to go to the site with the understanding that I have from the mythology and the law, L-O-R-E, law, in approaching the places and attempting to do that as respectfully as possible in order to listen. And usually that will involve a fairly unstructured, quiet, still ritual, and waiting for results for extended periods of time. I think the archaeologist Richard Bradley said a very useful thing, I think, from an archaeologist's perspective, which is that one of the things that we need to do with these sorts of monuments is spend a lot of time with them. And I think that goes for pagan and other alternative practitioners as well. It's not a matter of turning up once and spending half an hour at a site attempting to awaken the spirits. It's about going to that same place over and over again for extended periods and simply spending time there and through whatever means one has attempting to listen in order to glean insights. And for myself, I have gleaned various insights as a result. I've never seen myself as psychic or having any particular supernatural powers, hence I don't call myself a shaman or anything like that, but I have had effects and results that are meaningful to me in various ways through those kinds of still focused listening rituals.
And the investment of time is so key. I'm reminded of a principle in permaculture. Let's say you move into a new property and you're wondering how to construct it and make it bountiful along permaculture principles. And the first thing they recommend is that you just watch the site for a long time, maybe a year. Maybe being able to go through all the seasons, seeing how the water flows, seeing how the wind moves, seeing how the light operates throughout the year, and really just. But it's not just to gather information; it's also just this kind of temporal commitment and a sort of slowing down, and that seems to be a really key element with these and with so many practices. I mean, it's almost like if it doesn't take a lot of time, it might not be worth the effort. Or if it's the only thing you can do, you're traveling, you want to see the place, you open up, you do what you can, that's great. Things can come through all over the place. You never know when grace or that kind of relationality is going to arise. But to the degree that it is intentional and over time, that sort of pace is also seems to be a really key element for that. I'm also curious how you see things. I mean, I know this is a big question, but just, you know, even from the top of your head, how you see paganism or neo-shamanism, as it's expressed in the UK in any case, changing now. What are the ways that things are shifting, let's say, from a kind of, you know, crazy, ripe, countercultural 1970s into the early 80s kind of zone where a lot of this stuff sort of got opened up, and now there's this kind of generational shift, and I think people in a lot of ways are more sophisticated. There's also all sorts of things have changed with the Internet, et cetera, et cetera. When you go to the sites in particular and you see how people are continuing to use and are changing their use of sites, from a religious point of view, what are some, you know, larger shifts that you see in the culture?
Well, nothing has changed in the sense of diversity of engagement. So paganism is as diverse, or perhaps more diverse, than it's ever been, and therefore the forms of relationship or acting that happens at sites is, if anything, more diverse than it ever has been. But I think that paganism has, as Ronald Hutton's put it, has reached a certain stage of maturity now, since the 1950s, say, or earlier than that, and that this patience that we've been talking about has been something which has come to the fore, perhaps influenced by scholars talking about new animism and pagans reading about and talking to scholars about new animism. And I think that's been an interesting development in terms of actual engagements with sites, less of an imposition, less of an impact, but more of a patient listening. So I think paganism has been maturing. I think that there are many more people going to archaeological sites and approaching them as sacred places than there have been, from the large popular ones such as Stonehenge to much smaller out-of-the-way ones that we used to go to for some of our rituals and not see anyone, and now there may well be people or evidence of people having been there. At the same time, now we're dealing with what, second, third generation pagans who have been brought up as pagan or who have children who have also been brought up as pagan. So quite a lot's changed over the generations in that, as a result, there is now more acceptance, I think. When I started out in paganism, it was rather, for me at least, it felt rather hidden and risque and alternative. I think now it looks far less so. And a good example of that would be the summer solstice celebrations at Stonehenge, which I've been to many times and which I've studied as well and written about. But there, it didn't used to be that there would be every walk of life there. There would be a quite alternative crowd. Now there could be anyone there. And they may well, of course, just be visiting just for the crack, just to see what it's like at summer solstice at Stonehenge. But at the same time, there are many, many people there from various walks of life that are going for a spiritual, say, kind of a reason. So there's some of the ways in which I think we've seen change, but perhaps most importantly, for the most part, a more respectful engagement with the sites, I think.
So I know you have a piece in this wonderful new book that just came out called The Handbook of Contemporary Animism, and this is edited by Graham Harvey, who you mentioned earlier, who wrote a terrific and a pretty influential book on animism. And I'm hoping to get him on the show soon, partly because this handbook is really terrific. And there's, you know, many issues, many dimensions of this anthropological, archaeological, looking through the past, developing new philosophical models that take into account. There's many things to say about this topic of new animism. But for you, and particularly when you talk to audiences, what is sort of some of the key or one of the key ideas or directions that you see is emerging out of what is a, becoming a pretty significant conversation across many different disciplines, this question of how do we think about and revise the ideas of animism.
Yeah, it is significant and having an ongoing impact, I think, particularly because it rocks the foundations of Western philosophical thinking, or at least perhaps not so much the more recent thinking, but it does question the ways in which we've engaged with the world as Euro-Americans for quite a long time. Because if we take seriously that, if we take indigenous thinking seriously, which we should, because that would be the respectful thing to do, then there might be some sense in talking to a rock and calling it grandfather. So it's an interesting philosophical line to explore. But for my archaeological work, what I've done is bring new animism to bear on the research I've done on shamanism and rock art. And one of the exciting things for me for new animism and its impact on shamanism is that it becomes more about relating to the world we live in, and shamans as the mediators between the human world and the other-than-human world. Previously, shamans had tended to be singled out as important individuals who were somehow more in contact with the spirit world than other people, who journeyed to the spirit world in order to encounter various spirits, and who worked with, negotiated, fought with those spirits in order to bring back knowledge, healing, and game food for their communities. So we had, I think, this rather stereotyped Western version of a shaman, which was an individual who altered their consciousness in some way, believed they went on a journey, encountered spirits, did stuff in the spirit world, and then brought back knowledge of some kind for their communities. But new animism puts a whole new spin on that, which disrupts, I think, a lot of Western baggage within that. One of those is that the shaman is a significant individual of some kind, which I think sounds more Western and problematic than it does indigenous. The emphasis on altered state of consciousness, which altered states, which of course is its own form of Western psychological construction, that there is a normal state of consciousness and that there are altered states, and the notion of spirits, which of course, if there is going to be spirit, then there has to be matter, and that's another dualism that we've imposed as Westerners. And what new animism has done to that is shake those foundations and say, well, if animism is about relating to the world respectfully, then what shamans are actually doing is acting as mediators within a wider than human world, so that humans aren't the top dogs on the planet and are actually struggling along with everything else on the planet in terms of trying to find their way and not actually knowing everything. Shamans are those who are able to adjust their styles of communication, which is a new spin on ASCs, altered states of consciousness, adjusted styles of communication. Shamans are the ones who profess the ability to be able to do that. And whether or not they're engaging with spirits or the indigenous terms they're using, which might be more to do with allies and others and significant persons rather than some kind of spirits, and doing that and attempting to communicate, attempting to understand, not necessarily being accomplished at it, but aiming for accomplishment in doing that. And then, as a result of that, attempting to negotiate harmony between the varieties of persons that there are. And given that it's usually human persons who cause offense, who disrupt the living world, then it behooves the human community to attempt to negotiate harmony with the others, with the other than human persons, and it's shamans who attempt to do that.
Yeah, that was a wonderful summation or sketch of some of these concerns, and it really has been delightful for me reading more into this conversation, because it's really the first time since I was a young person going through contemporary theory, philosophy, media theory, et cetera, that since the sort of wave of ideas around, you know, media theory and postmodernism and the new technologies and things that were really influential to me younger, as a younger person, that this conversation about animism has a depth and significance that is actually rare for today's kind of scholarly world. And it's something that I very much hope people who mostly ignore scholarship for very good reasons often are able to engage, and that simultaneously that the people who are opening up to this discourse, who are putting a lot of work into it, also keep their feelers out there for the ways in which people are coming up with new ways of relating to the world. And it does seem to be a really marvelous development. And, you know, we're winding up here, and I wanted to give you a shout out to one of the significant relationships in your life, I know, which is your relationship to your falcon. And, you know, I find falconry absolutely romantic, and you've done it. And I'd love just to give you a spot here to talk about that, how that arose and how that works into your life.
Well, she's a hawk. She's a Harris hawk rather than a falcon. So she's a broad wing rather than a long wing, to use a falconry term. Since I was a boy and my mum encouraged me to be interested in the natural world, particularly birds, and I developed a passion for birds of prey and visited the Hawk Conservancy Trust, which is actually not far now from where I live in Hampshire. And I was there as a small boy, 8 years old, and had a falconry glove on and held a barn owl and was utterly amazed by the fact that I could be so close to an utterly wild creature. Okay, that's a construct, but I think you know what I mean. And really felt something very, very resonant there, to go back to our earlier conversation, and always wanted from that point forward to be a falconer. And it's something that I've only really been able to explore very recently in the last couple of years. I reached that point in my life where I thought either this is going to happen or it's not. So I went on a course and decided that it was something I could do. And I haven't looked back since, and it has been a dream come true. I think falconry suffers from a romantic perception. It isn't entirely romantic. You know, it's out there in nature. It's bloody. It involves hard work and patience and death. But there are some of the qualities that make it such a real and addictive thing. I'm under no illusions that the bonds that I have with my hawk through training her and spending a lot of time with her to for want of a better word, make her tame. She'll never be tame. She's a wild creature. But all of that time, I'm under no illusion that she in any way likes me necessarily, that we have a some sort of romantic relationship, that I'm special in having been able to train her. I've just followed the program and have trained her, and we do have a bond, but she will always remain a wild creature in the sense that if I do not have contact with her every day, if I don't fly her, if we don't go hunting, then she will be completely wild and not want to be near me. She will attempt to fly away or not come back or fly away at my presence. So it's an ongoing negotiating of a relationship. And it's very difficult to have that cross-species conversation, as Donna Haraway would put it. I've been rereading her Companion Species Manifesto, a prickly paradigm book, in which she talks about dogs, people, and significant otherness. And I see a lot of similarities between that significant otherness and the relationship I have with my hawk, Freya. And it's an ongoing project. And it's really interesting to attempt to have that cross-species conversation. And I guess that as we're ending on this note, you can see how this relates to everything else that we've been talking about in terms of my study and personal spiritual practice and thinking.
Yeah, it's a wonderful place to wind up. And I just want to underscore one connection between a lot of the conversations today is that it's precisely in that moment where you recognize and are able to affirm, let's just call it for the sake of conversation, her wildness, the point at which there's no entrance into some kind of charmed communication circuit. That there is a place, a point of conversation, there is a point of relationship, but that point of relationship only goes so deep, and then beyond that is something that is impossible to assimilate, is impossible to own, is impossible to control. And rather than filling up that space with some kind of concept about a spirit, about the nature of this particular animal, the nature of hawks, there's a willingness to just go as far as you can go and then hold it open. And then and that gesture seems to me that extra degree of respect, that sort of authentic, if you will, animist moment that requires more subtlety, and it requires more pragmatism in some ways. You only can do what you can do. But also an even greater kind of heart, because you can't know it. You can't rely on, you can't lean on the spiritual overbelief. It's something subtler in a lot of ways. So I think that's a remarkable relationship there. We only got about a minute left. I wanted to give you the opportunity to let people know where they might find some of your work online, if you have new things coming out, you know, the generic plug time before we go.
I'm afraid I don't have very much online that I put there myself. I don't have my own website, but if you were to go to the Richmond University website and look under faculty for Robert Wallace, you'd find a list of my publications. And the thing I'm working on mainly at the moment, apart from a second edition of the Historical Dictionary of Shamanism with Graham Harvey, is a book on art and shamanism, which is something we haven't talked about so much, including contemporary art. And I'm interested in the way that art and shamanism have been constructed as concepts and entangled over time from the Renaissance to the present. So that's my longer-term project.
That sounds wonderful. And when that comes out, I'll have to have you back on the show, if not earlier. Thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thank you, Eric.
All right. Folks, for me, to all you out there, keep your minds open.